Welcome to this audio recording by the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to promoting public awareness of global issues and the ways in which they affect the Dallas-Fort Worth region. Become a member today at dfwworld.org and help us connect North Texas with the world. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
After that, I've got nowhere to go but down. It's terrible to come back to Fort Worth because everybody here that I've known from the last some years, 60 or 70 or so, remembers me in short pants. And I'm delighted that I'm wearing long ones today. But I hope you all will not think of me just in short pants. It's nice to be here, among others, with old friends from Fort Worth that I've known for all these years, and a former colleague of mine from the State Department, Edward Thomas, who reminds me of a joke about what happens to a person who comes and addresses a group like this. It was said to be many years ago a terrible flood in the Chesapeake Valley in Washington, near Washington, and there was an old man who regarded that as a major experience of his life. And he loved to tell the story of this great experience. And, of course, he was an awful bore, and everybody ran and hid behind cars and ducked into doorways and so forth to get away from him. And he finally died and went to heaven. And he was met outside the Golden Gate and was told that even though he was a terrible bore, he had been a reasonably decent man, and so he could have one last wish. And his wish was to have a proper audience so he could tell this great event of his life. And St. Peter said, well, I just want to tell you that Noah is going to be there. So having Mr. Thomas here, who's been all over that area too, I'm a little bit worried about Noah being in the audience. But perhaps some of the rest of you will be more tolerant. There are two subjects that I was supposed to talk about today, and I think our host flipped a coin and decided which one of the two I was to do. And I may get mixed up at some point and shift from one to the other. So if I do, maybe somebody will alert me that I have made a mistake and come back again. But I want to start out at least by talking about the Iraqi situation, because I think it is enormously dangerous, costly, and I think it's going to get much worse. And so I will set out to ruin what is left of your can't hear. I'll set out to ruin what's left of your meal for you. The question that I'm sure sticks on many people's minds is that better? I have a soft voice and I'm also partly deaf, so it's I've got a great combination here. If you don't hear, please throw something at me or speak up again. That would probably blast you out of the room. The first question I think everybody wants to know about is why we went into Iraq. There have been a whole series of reasons, excuses, and various other things that have come up. The first one, of course, was the belief that Iraq had nuclear weapons, which it didn't have, that the Iraqi government was supporting terrorism, which it wasn't. Because Osama bin Laden, the principal terrorist of that period, and perhaps still, offered, in fact, to raise a military force to fight Saddam Hussein. The two men were totally incompatible and very much opposed to each other's policies. Unfortunately, today, Iraq is now a school for terrorism and is going to get very much worse in the period ahead. The cost of the war is absolutely staggering. I'm sure most of you read about this all the time in the press, but the numbers mount up almost day by day. Approximately 2,500 young American soldiers have been killed, 16,000 have been wounded, of whom about 8,000 will be permanently disabled and will have to be taken care of all their lives. There are about 40,000 who have such severe psychological damage that they are under psychiatric care at the present time. and they will have to be paid for essentially for all of their lives too. Nearly 500 private contractors have been killed, 39 journalists, about 15 diplomats. That's on the American side. On the Iraqi side, somewhere nobody really has a clue exactly what the number is, but estimates run between 30,000 and 100,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed. And since Iraq is only about 10% of the size of the United States, that means that virtually every man, woman, and child in the country has a relative who's been killed. And that explains why all the reports that we get back indicate the growing hostility to Americans. We are regarded as the people who killed Uncle so-and-so or the next-door neighbor. The monetary cost, which is something that everybody in this room has to be concerned about, is about, according to the latest calculation, which was done by Joseph Stiglitz, who won the Nobel Prize in economics a short time ago, $2 trillion. That works out to approximately $8,000 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. And the current out-of-pocket expenses, that is, current running expenses, are approximately $6 billion a month, or $230 million a day, or $10 million an hour to keep us in Iraq. So this raises the question of what really has happened and what we're doing and what we can count on doing ahead. The effects fall into three categories: what has happened to us, what's happened to the Iraqis, and what's happened to the American position in the world. U.S. casualties and money are the two obvious ones that one reads about in the press. But in addition to that, I think there is a particular danger to our society of what you might think of as the dehumanizing effects of a guerrilla war. The young men we've sent to Iraq, young men and women, are ordinary, nice young people out of typical American society. But they have become traumatized, of course, by the nature of a guerrilla war, where people are shooting at them, where bombs are going off, and so forth. And they have seen killing has become commonplace. And in addition, this terrible scandal of torture in Abu Ghraib prison and various other places has, I think, traumatized virtually a whole generation of young Americans. The statistics bear that out. As I mentioned, approximately 40,000 of them feel that they need psychiatric care when they've come back. And the consequences of that for our society are something that I think we're going to have a great deal of trouble with in the years ahead. One of the other aspects has been the corruption of American business activities. We have not accounted for the vast amounts of money that we poured into Iraq and that we've used of the Iraqis. One particular business had a cost overrun of nearly $1 billion on a contract that it did. Some of the investigations are going on all the time in the Corps of Engineers and various other groups to find out what's happened. Some of the stories are really almost unbelievable. But the major problem has, of course, been the failure of the activities. It's hard, I think, for people who've not been in Baghdad to realize how limited and restricted our activities are. Many years ago, I went out to Vietnam in the early part of the Vietnamese War, and I stood on the roof of the American Embassy in downtown Saigon with Henry Cabot Lodge, who was then our ambassador, and we watched a firefight between people in the downtown city. And I had an Army colonel as my aide at that time, and he said, "Would you like to buy a tank?" And I said, "I really don't have a particular need for a tank right now." But he said, "It's an incredible thing that on the black market in Saigon, you can buy a tank." And I thought to myself, well, that means we really lost the war. In Baghdad, as one of the American businessman, the head of a group called the Washington Group International, commented, even walks in the American so-called green zone in the center of Baghdad are prohibited. He said, life here is very much like being in a prison. And when you read in the newspaper accounts a dispatch which is headlined Baghdad, what you're really reading is somebody who might be in a building like this, but who can't go across the street. The reporters all use local help to go out and come back and tell them what's going on, because they can't go and see anything themselves. What we have had to do because of the Iraq war also impacts on us in another way. In the year 2004, last year, we borrowed $540 billion, primarily from China. An awful lot of that, of course, was to support the kind of activities of what Iraq entails. So we have saddled our children and our grandchildren with what you might think of as a birth tax. For every new child who's born, he starts with a $150,000 debt at the time of his birth. The most important thing, however, the effects of the Iraq war are on our position in world affairs. When I was a young man, I traveled all over Africa and Asia. In fact, was in Baghdad just about 3 days before the invasion. I was able to walk around the streets everywhere, talk to anybody I wanted to. Any little Asian or African village I went into, the only danger that I had was that everybody was vying to invite me to come and have a meal in his house. Today, if I went to any of those places, I would probably be shot. It's very difficult, I think, for us Americans who think of ourselves and are decent, honorable, friendly people to realize how incredible the change of our position in the world has been, primarily because of the Iraq war. All the polls indicate a growing hatred of America, even in England, even in our closest ally. And it was said that before the last election, people drew a distinction between Americans and their government. They thought our government was bad because the government got us into the Iraq war, but the American people were nice, and everyone wanted to be like the American people or to live here. But apparently today that is also declining. And it's a painful and difficult thing, I think, for any of us to think about what kind of a change that was. Iraqi society has been shattered by the war. And it's easy to say that, and it's difficult to read the newspapers, and you find the Sunnis are shooting at the Shiites, and the Shiites and the Kurds are fighting with one another, and you think, well, there really is no hope of that society getting back together again. And I thought about this several times, that if you think of this in terms of Fort Worth, if you thought that we had been invaded, let's say, by the Chinese or the Russians, and our society similarly had been shattered, the police all ran away, the fire department stopped working, a lot of our buildings were destroyed, we didn't have electricity most of the time, 40 or 50% unemployment, people's salaries were not being paid, and so forth, you'd find a similar type of social disruption. And if you thought about it in Fort Worth terms, the Sunnis are perhaps like the white community, a relatively large but still minority group. And the Shiites are perhaps like the Latin community, a majority. The black community are like the Kurds. And what has happened is that the three groups which did have a relationship, relatively peaceful, relatively stable relationship in the past, are now set against one another. And they're all vying for position. And they're all heavily armed. So that every day, 100 or 200 people get killed. And this has now been going on for 3 years. And there seems to be no end in sight as long as we're there. So each group is trying to reconstitute the society, but on its own terms, and at the end of a rifle or a machine gun. Everyone seems to believe that there is no real hope for accomplishing the originally stated objectives. So the result is that this enormous amount of money, these casualties and so forth, are very largely wasted. And the incredible thing, I think, is that most of us really remain quite ignorant about what's happening. There's a wonderful saying that war is God's way of teaching Americans geography. But we're very poor pupils. After 3 years of war, the National Geographic did a survey of young Americans and found that 6 out of every 10 Americans of military age were unable to locate Iraq on a map, much less knowing who lived there or what language they spoke or what their background was or their politics or anything else. So the question in my mind is, can we stay the course, as President Bush says? I think the answer is absolutely not. And that is the opinion of all the senior generals who've retired since the war, one after another. They've come out and said that they see no possibility of our winning the war, and that they urge their fellows, as General Gregory Newbold of the Marine Corps recently did, to stand up and speak out against what we're now doing for the good of the country. General Joseph Hoar, who was formerly the commander of the Central Command, said, "We're looking into the abyss." The spread of terrorism is unquestionably a major aspect of what we're doing. It's pitted us against 1.2 billion Muslims around the world, and we have no allies left. Even the British public is thoroughly against us today. I see that very much, spending as much time as I do in Europe, that the feeling of friendship and so forth toward the Americans is very largely dissipated. I might, in the middle of this lugubrious recession of events, tell you an amusing episode that I had during the Vietnam War. I gave a lecture on the Vietnam War in the National War College in Washington in 1962, I think it was, and I went through a similar range of issues as I've done today and predicted finally that we were going to lose the war. Well, my audience was made up of young colonels and brigadier generals and so forth who were desperately anxious to get out to Vietnam because that's where they got promoted and they got decorations and so forth. And they were absolutely furious. I thought I was going to be lynched before I got out of the room. And years went by, and they asked me to come back and give another talk. And I said I would, but on the condition that I could talk about the same theme. But that time I was a little more cagey than I'd been the first time, and I said that I wanted to be provocative to make everybody think about the issue. And an Army Brigadier General got up, and he said, "I don't know why you're pulling your punches on this. We all agree with you." And then I told him the story of my first time lecturing at the War College. He said, "Yes, but we've all been there now." In other words, it was a very expensive school that we'd been through. So I think the question really is, or two questions. One is, what do we do about Iraq? And the second one is, what do we learn from that experience? One of the curious things is that the man I mentioned, or I guess I hadn't mentioned, General Odom, who was the former head of the National Security Agency, our principal super-secret spy agency, wrote an article just a couple of weeks ago in which he said, "Cut and run, you bet. We better get out of Iraq no matter what and do it right away." I think that's a very poor choice. I think that to have the feeling in the American public that we have run away in a sort of tail between our legs attitude will impact very badly on our society, as indeed the Vietnam War did. It's terribly easy for people after a bad experience like this to say, "Well, we were winning, and then the politicians sold us out." And you will remember that that was exactly what Hitler used to move into his power, by claiming that Germany had won the First World War and the politicians at home were the traitors and sold them down the river. We must not allow that to happen. The great thing that we have going for us as Americans is that whatever we disagree with one another about, whatever we have going, we are a coherent society. We are, generally speaking, an open and tolerant society who are prepared to listen to one another even if we disagree with one another. And if we get into a position in which we find a sense that some of us were traitors in this event, it will be a terrible thing for the lives of our children and grandchildren. We must look at the Iraqi experience head on and realize exactly what happened and what we can do about it. Some of the Army generals involved believe that we should buy our way out with a very heavy yearly payment to the Iraqi government. I don't think that's the case. I don't think it's really about money. I don't think the issue is going to be solved by just dumping a great deal of money into the country. He called for roughly $10 billion a year to be dumped onto Iraq as a way to salvage our reputation. I think what needs to happen is a rather more complicated thing, and I should tell you that former Senator George McGovern, who ran for the presidency in 1972, and I have just finished a book which is coming out in September to be called Out of Iraq, where, among other things, I have written the chapter, as I used to do when I was in the government, as a member of the Policy Planning Council, a coherent program of what we have to do to get out with the least possible damage. We have to all be very sober about this and recognize that there is no perfect solution. There is no easy way out. As we all know in our personal lives, it's far easier to fall into a mistake or a bad situation than it is to get out. But there is a way we can get out, and we should do it as quickly as possible. At $10 million an hour, it's very much to our interest to do it soon rather than later. What the British learned in the American Revolution, which leads me to say just a word about the other book that you saw out there, The Early History of America, is that you can't win a guerrilla war with a formal army. We couldn't win Vietnam. The British couldn't win against the Americans in the Revolutionary War. We certainly can't control what's going to happen during the transition period when we get out. There certainly is going to be a lot of bloodshed. There certainly is going to be a great deal of chaos. There are going to be very bad things happening. But there already are. We're already in a period of chaos. And we have to recognize that that's the price that's going to be paid for having made the mistake of invading Iraq. What we need to do, it seems to me, is to learn the lesson of what this amounts to, what this is all about, because we want to be very sure that we don't duplicate Vietnam and Iraq with yet another catastrophe of the same kind. I have been impressed as a historian by remembering what the German philosopher of history, Hegel, said, that nobody ever learned from history, and no government ever learned from the mistakes of its policy. And the American philosopher Santayana capped that by saying that those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And that's what we must not do. Now, what I propose to do is to stop there, hear objections, questions, and whatever, and I'd ask you to talk fairly loudly because of my impairment of my ears. And as my wife reminded me on the telephone last night, I very stupidly left my hearing aids behind. Yes, sir.
I can ask the first question. You have such a wealth of knowledge about the history of Iraq. Could you talk about how the country, in a worst case, could be broken up into three different entities and the impact that would have on Turkey and so forth?
Yes, sir. The problem about the – this is a – let me be mean about some of my colleagues, all the great experts on Iraq. One of the worst things about us Americans is we're all looking for simple solutions. We love the idea of problem-solution, and we all try to think, I think, all too often of gimmicks. So the idea is you've got these three people who are not getting along very well together, and the best thing to do is just split them apart and have another give each one of them some place to live. Go back to the analogy of Fort Worth I used a few minutes ago. If you thought here you've got a situation where you have the Mexican community unhappy with the black community and the black community unhappy with the white community. Best thing to do is create three different societies. But then you've got Dallas next door that has the same group, and Houston has the same group, and so forth. So you have hundreds of thousands of people who are going to have to leave their homes and move someplace else. And in the course of doing that, they will lose all the things that they have saved all their lives, and their positions and their neighbors and so forth. And if you think about this, even in a small country, Iraq is only 27 million people, the dislocations of splitting up the country into three parts are going to create something that will make the Balkans look like an easy outing for us. It's going to perpetuate the hostilities and the problems, and also will invite in the neighboring countries to each one of them espouse their local adherents or fight their local enemies. So we would create an unstable situation that would last for years, if not decades. Yes, ma'am.
I'm not quite sure that I get the question. I think your statement is basically that we're in a very complicated situation in which there isn't an easy answer, but that we need to protect ourselves. How do we do it? I think, first of all, you have to start with the fact that Iraq was not threatening us in any way. Iraq had nothing to do with the 9/11 attack. Iraq has no military capacity to attack anywhere that we're interested in. The Iraq war is not related to the terrorist issue. The terrorist issue is another thing, which if you invite me back again, I'd be glad to talk about. But it's not part of the Iraq issue. There are a lot of other problems in the Middle East, but yes, sir.
Talk about how to get out of Iraq. I don't know how the hell you get out of Iraq.
Yep. Well, the first one you can probably answer better than I can. I think it's awfully hard for any administration to admit they made a mistake. You remember how hard it was for Lyndon Johnson to admit the mistakes on Vietnam, and, of course, later very hard for the next administration, the Nixon administration, to do a similar thing. Political people don't like to admit mistakes. They like to find new ways to cover them over, and I think we have to expect that it'll be very difficult for this administration to admit what happened. The second question is that I, growing up here, was very much aware of American history as a child. I've always been interested in history, and as you know, I was a professor of history at the University of Chicago and taught history before that at Harvard. And I found that I was very ignorant about American history. And I then read a great deal by historians, and I found that they were all looking at American history from the inside only. And we are such a diverse people from all over the world, with all of our different backgrounds, all of our different cultures, all of our different aspirations, that I got fascinated with how it was that we look upon ourselves. You start with our first slogan, E Pluribus Unum. And it seemed to me that there was a lot more pluribus than there was unum in what we had to do. And that even worse, an awful lot of our fellow citizens were indeed ashamed of their background. When I was a little boy, I spent 1 year going to public school out in the Packinghouse district. And I don't remember a single person ever in that year speaking a word of Spanish. And as I look back on it now, I think that the children that I went to school with were simply ashamed of their Spanish background. And then when I was a college student, I taught in a settlement house in Boston with a group of Italian children. And for them, Italy was an ugly word. And the Italians meant the old grandmothers that had sort of mustaches, and they were the children didn't really want to know anything about that. And I took them one time to the Boston Fine Arts Museum, and they couldn't believe that an Italian ever drew a picture. And when they saw Michelangelo, this was just unbelievable. How did they even get that picture into the museum, much less how did he ever paint it? And so I found that the interesting thing to me was to start away from America and come to America. And that's, after all of our ancestors did. They all started someplace else. And the way that they came here was extraordinarily difficult, very frightening. And what they met when they got here was, as you point out, a very complicated, difficult situation in which they literally had to fight for life. And our historical heritage is an absolutely fascinating thing. And piece by piece by piece, I got into things that were alarming as well as encouraging. One of the things that really surprised me was how all of our children are turned off of history, because mostly it's taught in such a boring way. But it's such a fascinating story that if one could try to make it more interesting, we all would, I think, realize how much more we share and how many things we have in common that are worthwhile and worth preserving. So I tried to get into those things to bring them together and bring out almost a story rather than a history of our background. I have had the opportunity to study some 20 guerrilla wars, and sometimes very closely studying them. And I was in charge, for example, of the American Task Force on the Algerian War. And I dealt a lot with intelligence people and military people and so forth in the course of these events. Everybody usually tries to find an outsider to explain what the problem is. But you don't really need an outsider in the first place in most of these situations. People make their own decisions internally. And if you think about it, the idea of inserting an outsider in a small society that is culturally coherent like Iraq is very, very difficult. We know that during World War II, for example, for us to insert somebody into Greece required just enormous preparation ahead of time, all kinds of things to keep that person protected while he was doing whatever he was supposed to do. And it's the idea of inserting large numbers of people into Iraq from Iran or any place else is really a non-starter. But it's the kind of thing that we've looked for, because we really didn't want to face up the fact that the Iraqis had their own agenda. And their own agenda is a very simple one. It's the same one that the Vietnamese had. It's nationalism. We were foreigners. They didn't want us in their country. And if we had Chinese walking up and down the streets out here armed with Kalashnikovs, we'd all feel the same way about them. We wouldn't need somebody coming in from Germany to tell us what to do. Yes, ma'am. They certainly didn't get along perfectly, but using my analogy of Fort Worth, we have all kinds of problems between the different communities, but people weren't killing each other. And communities tended to control their own affairs. Traditionally, in Baghdad, for example, each neighborhood had its own water well, its own mosque or church or synagogue, because some of them were Christian. There are a million Christians in Iraq, or Jews, and they had their own marketplace, their own school, their own whatever the best they could do with a clinic and so forth, so that each neighborhood was coherent as a unit, and it abutted on people who were perhaps of a different religion or a different background. But the two weren't shooting at each other, and they got along, they traded with one another, they did all the things, just as I'm sure you find here in Fort Worth. And as long as you have a relatively benign situation, you don't have to try to control this with the police. But if you had a real breakdown of public order in Fort Worth, as a result of an invasion, let's say, of the Chinese or the Russians, and people began to shoot at each other, you couldn't control Fort Worth with 100,000 policemen. And that's the situation we're in Iraq. Yes, ma'am. I think the first task is to inform oneself what is going on, and that's very hard because the press is very disappointing. The press doesn't tell you a great deal about what's going on. As I mentioned, most of the people we send out there don't know the local languages, don't get out of their hotels, don't wander the streets and talk to people. To the best of my knowledge, we had only one American correspondent in Baghdad in the last 2 or 3 years who knew Arabic, which is the language. So that if you think, if there were, let's say, a Chinese journalist who came to New York to write about American politics, who stayed in the Waldorf Hotel and didn't speak English, you'd think that was really rather silly. But that's what we have to rely on to a very large extent. We had one person in the American occupation government who knew the language really well, who had been a student of mine, in fact, Ambassador Horan. And we were really flying blind. As Paul Bremer says in his account of his year in Baghdad, he was not even aware that the State Department had spent $5 million over a period of a year and a half with 60 supposed experts on Iraq producing a very detailed account of what was likely to happen as a result of the invasion. He didn't even know that existed until some months after he'd been in the country, and then he finally read parts of it before he left. But we had, frankly, a much better situation in Vietnam than we have in Iraq, where in Vietnam we had a lot of people who, first of all, got out and got around the country and talked to people and saw what was happening. And we don't have that in Iraq. We had people who learned the local language, and we have practically nobody there who can go talk to people. When I went to Baghdad just 3 days before the invasion, I was able to walk around the streets and walk in and to a shop and pretend to buy a pencil and chat with the shop owner and talk to him about what he was thinking about, what he was worried about, and so forth. We didn't have anybody at all doing anything like that after the invasion. Yes, sir.
Could you speak to the issue of tribalism in Iraq versus democracy and why the American idea of democracy can't flourish in a land that's been tribal for 3,000 or 4,000 years?
Well, what you first of all have to do, I think, is to think that the model that we think of as democracy is not necessarily the only model there is. And what we're really talking about when we use the word democracy is people participating in control of their own lives. And in a tribe, the traditional idea that we have from the American Indians is very different from the Arab tribes. The Arab tribes did not have a, quote, chief, for example. And if anybody had tried to order the people to do various things, they wouldn't have paid any attention to him. A tribal society is extremely egalitarian because the groups are relatively small and people mind their own business or manage their own affairs. The British changed that a lot when they went into Iraq. They did what they call promoting the chiefs. They tried to impose on Iraq not democracy, but what they had encountered in the northwest frontier in India, fighting the Pathan tribesmen, the Kipling's people. And the Iraqis followed that to some extent because the British paid them to do so and encouraged a change of the tribal structure. But the tribal structure reasserted itself. And when Saddam Hussein really fell on evil days, he tried to fall back on the tribal system too. But what he found when he tried to do it was that the tribesmen weren't going to go along with the kind of authoritarian centralized government that he'd not created, but which he'd inherited from all the previous dictatorships. And one of the problems that we have now in Iraq is that we're desperately trying to build the army, which is the worst possible thing we could do. The army has always intervened in politics in Iraq to destroy civil governments. What Iraq needs is a police force, not an army. And it needs, preferably for a period of transition during this bad period of chaos, which will last 2 to 5, maybe 10 years, is a multinational police force that the Iraqi government can call on. And but we're not going to be able to impose what we think of as our model of democracy on almost anybody else. Everybody works on a different rhythm. I spend a lot of time in France these days. The French system of democracy is close to ours, but not quite the same thing. And to go back to your question about early America, years ago I bought a house in the little town of Harvard in Massachusetts. The house had been built in 1692 by a shipwright, and he didn't have any of the things he really needed to build a house. He didn't have any cement, he didn't have any glass, he didn't have any paint, he didn't have plaster, and so forth. And he wanted his house to look like England. And so what he did was he had beams holding up the second floor of the house, and to make it look like an English house that was plastered between the beams, he whitewashed the floor of the second floor to look like an English house. And it seemed to me that was a marvelous analogy of a lot of the things to make something look like what it had been otherwise. And people do that a lot with ideas as well as houses.
We have time for two more.
Right. Well, that's a big topic, but I'll try to give you just a couple of points on it. First, I think it's a mistake the way we single out religion as kind of an abstract idea. Religion encapsulates a culture, and that culture is a thing that has many dimensions, economic, geographical, ideas, as well as other things. Iraq basically splits into two religious groups, or three religious groups today that are important. As I mentioned, there are roughly 1 million Christians living in Iraq. In addition to that, the majority population are a sect of Islam that are called the Shia sect. And the Shia people are very much influenced by Persian culture. There's always been a split in the Middle East, or not always, but for the last 1,500 years, a split in the Middle East between a Persian orientation and an Arab orientation. And the Shia are very much oriented toward Persian culture. The Sunni population, who comprise the central Arab population in the country and the Kurdish population, are oriented toward the Arab background. And these two religions, of course, share a great deal. But as in the West, the split between Protestants and Catholics is often more bitter than the split between either one of them and people from other religions. If you look back at English history, for example, in the time of Queen Elizabeth, you recall that the government was hunting down and often killing the Catholics. And in Spain at the same period, the government was hunting down and killing the Protestants. And they were much more worried about people who were also Christian than other people. The Crusades, which we all read about in school, turn out to be more than anything else an attack on the Christians, by the Christians. The first thing that the Crusaders did when they got out to the Middle East was to round up all the local Christians and churches and burn the churches down to kill the people inside them. And the other famous crusade at the so-called Albigensian Crusade in France that destroyed the Cathar people down on the frontier of Spain was to hunt down and kill the Christians. And the leader of the Crusade army was asked what he did about the local people who were their adherents, and he said, kill them all. God will recognize his own. And so religious hostilities are terribly deep, but they're not just religion. They go back into all sorts of cultural, political, economic, and other factors. And the two people have several times, both recently and in 50 years ago, combined to fight the foreigners, because underneath religion is a strong sense of nationalism. And we're the outsiders. We're the foreigners. So that the Sunnis and the Shias both want us to get out. The present prime minister is a Shia, and his first remark is to get us out of the country. And the former foreign minister under the king was a Sunni, and he wrote me a letter one time and said, everybody in the country wants you Americans out. And he was our supposedly best friend in the country. Sorry.
Bill, I want to thank you so much for
thank you, sir.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.